Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuck nicks? What is happening? I am Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Got a couple of people on the show today. We got a nice talk with Paul Beatty, the author of The Sellout, a novel that kind of blew my mind. He's also written some other stuff that I haven't gotten to yet. But The Sellout, I got to, and it's one of the funniest fucking books I've ever read. Really just layers upon layers of funny and deep and cutting and smart. And I needed to talk to that guy, so he's here today. Also, my friend Jackie Cation will be here today. She's got a new record out. I Am Not the Hero of This Story. It's out now. She dropped by for a little bit. I always like seeing Jackie. Makes me laugh. She's one of the people that makes me laugh. How's it going out there for you people? Are you all right? Friday night, this Friday, I'll be in Austin, Texas. Next, am I going to go to Opie's Barbecue out in Spicewood? Is that going to happen? Do my pills erase that? See, I haven't gotten into that mindset. I haven't gotten into the mindset where, all right, these statins mean I can eat whatever the fuck I want, right? I haven't gotten to that mindset yet because I haven't gotten to blood tests to see how they're doing. Next weekend, Boulder, Colorado at the Boulder Theater, April 7th at the Paramount Theater, April 8th. And those are the nearest to us as far as dates go. Like I said, the shows have been good. I've been having a good time stretching it out, doing an hour and a half, 2 hour shows, trying to find that hour 10 for the special that I'll be taping in Minneapolis. If you know, that's another thing. Why don't I tell you about that? If you're in Minneapolis, I'm going to be doing two shows at the Pantages Theater on April 29th for a Netflix special. Let's assume everything will be in place in terms of the world and most of the federal government. I'll be there. I'll be doing that. So come out to that. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour to get linked up to the tickets there and see the rest of the dates coming up in Portland and Philly and DC and Madison and Milwaukee. But yeah, we did Oakland last week with Dean Del Rey. We did the Fox Theater in Oakland. What a stunning venue. What an amazing theater that was. It was a pretty good time. We had a good show. Dino did good. I did good. But I've been dealing with some odd vocalizing in the room lately. For some reason, I'm in the middle of my set in Oakland. And then some guy just starts screaming, you can save John Frusciante. You're the only guy that can save John Frusciante. Have John Frusciante on the show. You can save him. And I'm like, okay, you know, I don't mind engaging with the audience a tad. And, I said, yeah, I hear you. I mean, it might be a tall order to save John Frusciante from what I understand. But maybe. And I thought I settled him down, but he just kept screaming. He kept screaming it. And I guess they removed him. Very odd heckle. I don't know if I would call it a heckle as much as a disruption or a desperate plea to help somebody out. But it was odd, and it was jarring. and I had to rejigger and reconnect and move on. But I don't mind, you know, I don't mind pleasant crowd interaction. But then I go up to Seattle the following night, and it was good. It was a good show. I love Seattle. Saw some nice people. I had dinner with Lynn Shelton. She's going to be directing my Netflix special. She lives up there. And that was cool. And then we go do the show. A guy from there opened for me, Yogi Paliwal. He did a good job. Had to deal with a little weirdness from the crowd. There's a lot of wooing, which is okay, you know, in context, maybe at the beginning. But, you guys know how I feel about that. But then there's a woman up front who was drunky and just kept talking. Just kept talking to me, kept talking at me. Most of the rest of the room couldn't hear it, but it became disturbing and disrupting. She kept interrupting, and I would tell her to shut up in a nice way, and then I'd apologize for being abrasive. But by the third time, I was like, shut the fuck up. Enough already. Then she got upset, and the man she was with got upset. It's like, it was, well-intentioned, but unnerving and disruptive. And then, I felt myself being kind of guarded and a little defensive. And I felt myself drifting into old habits and wanting to, burn the set down. But I did not. I did not do that. And all in all, it was nice to be in Seattle. And I was very excited on Sunday to be going to Vancouver, to be flying to Vancouver, because I love Vancouver. I fucking love that city. I've always loved that city. And now even more on some level, and I've talked about this before recently, just to fly in or to get off a plane in Canada, to feel the cultural shift, the weight of the malignant kind of cultural darkness that is upon us here. Even if you're not looking at your phone, even if you're not looking at TV, you just feel the weight of the shift into this this tense and uncomfortable and frightening environment down here. And then to sort of step into the world of Vancouver, which is, beautifully integrated, nice and calm. People are pleasant. They're not just polite, but they're warm. And maybe I'm romanticizing, maybe I'm generalizing, but I felt relaxed. And my opener, Charlie Demers, very bright, funny guy. And I just relaxed and opened up. And then the following day, I stayed an extra day because I like Vancouver so much. And I went to this place that makes shoes. And I don't always go out into the world and, engage or what. But, I like boots. But these people were very nice. They're very, earnest. And it's called Love Jewels Leather Shoe Company. They started small and they are still really small. But it's almost like a shoe made to order place, because they're in such demand. So I went over there to this weird part of Vancouver that seemed a little industrial. I didn't know what I was getting into or where I was or what the lowdown was. And I go to this address. It's an unmarked building. I go upstairs. It's like an artist building where there's spaces for creative people. Mostly artists, functioning, working artists. I don't know if they're functioning, but they're working. But this Love Jewels Weather Company, the shoe company, they've got this big corner space up top where they're making boots and shoes. Just a bunch of nice young folks, artisans, leather shoe artisans making the stuff. And I got to talking to everybody and they measured my feet. They're going to make me some shoes. And it was one of those moments where I'm in Vancouver. I like the food. I like the people. The scenery's great. What could I just come up here and intern at a shoemaking place? Could I become a cobbler? I think that might be the next. That's part of my fantasies, is disappearing to some other part of the world where I just cobble, where I just work quietly and bend leather over souls. I can do it, man. If I focus, I can do it. Jackie Cation is a great friend of mine, and I think she's very funny. She's got a new record out. I'm Not the Hero of This Story. You can get it now. She also hosts the podcast The Dork Forest and the Jackie and Lori Show, which she does with Lori Kilmartin, who I also love. So she stopped by. So this is me and Jackie hanging out for a few minutes. How many possums do
There's
you see
a whole
at once?
Family. Whole family of possums saw him one night. Creeped me the fuck out.
Yeah, they're like gargoyles.
Right. It was two possums and three baby possums. It was kind of cute,
but
I stayed in my car.
That's my feeling on it is that, you know, baby possums are cute and then something bad happens. They don't stay cute. They just...
Yeah.
There's nothing appealing about a possum, the way it moves.
It was, the waddle. Ugh. I'll tell you, it was... You know, I appreciate seeing a complete family as much as anyone.
Sure.
And so it was lovely to watch them, but I was not getting out of my car. Yeah.
It wasn't that sweet that they're all together. Those ugly, horrible things that are, I think, relatively harmless, but they're just...
But super intimidating looking.
Disturbing looking.
Yes.
So, wait, now, you have the iguana's old now?
Yeah, the iguana's old. Andy got him, right? Back in the day.
Back in what day? Like, what day do you buy an iguana?
He didn't. He was working at PlayStation, Sony PlayStation.
This is your husband.
Designer, my husband. And so you should know, before you ask and email me at jackie@jackiecation.com, what games did he work on? Here's the famous game he worked on. God of War 2, God of War 3.
Oh, those?
Those, yeah.
I
those
know
are,
nothing about
exactly.
it. Yeah.
And he was part of a large, large team. So calm down.
Yeah.
It's a great job. You were correct.
But he's still a genius.
He's a genius.
Okay.
And it's
good.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So his one of his level designer buddies shows up at work with three iguanas that the guy Impulse bought.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's not my friend. I don't buy much, but right. I don't think that would be it.
I wouldn't impulse buy an animal on a dare.
Right. And don't impulse buy anything that eats.
Three of them. Iguanas grow to be 3.5 feet long.
So you've kept this thing and you...
Right.
And
so,
you can't really go like, I'm just going to let it go.
Right. Oh, yeah. No. Then it'll be in the sewers of that Los Angeles doesn't have. But the crazy thing is, so he was like, who wants an iguana after he is alerted to this fact? So Andy took one. Another guy at work took one. Those two guys, the guy who bought them and the other guy, they killed their iguanas in the first year.
They killed them on purpose?
No. They accidentally... Iguanas are actually quite difficult to get to maturity.
Yeah.
Because they're tiny. They're like the size of my hand.
Yeah.
Right? When they're little.
Right.
And you have to kind of make sure that they get enough light and the right kind of light and all these things.
Oh, you guys really cared for the reptile.
Andy is the one. I am not. I am...
So now you have this sort of old Galapagos looking...
Very much
regal
so.
Iguana.
He is regal. He is regal. Tiberius Gracchus is his name.
Of course it is.
Yes, it's named after the Roman general Tiberius Gracchus, because Andy is overeducated.
Yeah, and nothing wrong with that, I guess. Mm-hmm. Always, never a shortage of conversation.
Right, never. Yeah. Never a dull moment.
So what? I haven't seen you in years, I feel like. Is that possible?
It's been a year and a half easily, I think.
Really?
I think I saw you at the... My favorite times of seeing you in the last couple of years was I pulled into the comedy store.
Right.
And you yelled at me, what are you doing here, Cation? And I said, what are you doing here? And I'm like, I'm on the wall. What are you doing here? And I was like, I'm just looking for free parking.
I'm on the wall. I have to be here.
Exactly. You're on the wall.
It's been prophesized.
The prophecy has come true.
That's fucking hilarious. Mm-hmm. When people tell me I say things, I'm like, what an asshole.
Well, I know. It actually made me laugh so hard. Whenever anybody asks me to do that, I'm always like, what's the parking situation?
Yeah.
Because that's all I want.
That's all you care about. So after a certain age,
I'm done. I'm like, you booked me, I never worked the Laugh Factory either, but I'm like, how's the... The valet still there?
Yeah.
Because I'll do it. I'm willing to pay $10 to...
I never work there because I don't know really where to park. You know, they send you behind this building and you're not sure if it's okay.
Right. I don't work there because I don't know where to park either. Hilarious that we don't work there because we're like, well, I don't know.
It's just not clear to me. Like, because you drive up and then, someone told me once you'd pull into that. There's a building across the street on the same side of the street.
Okay.
You go through an archway and then you go into the back of this apartment building.
La, 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 la.
Right.
You've already lost me.
Well, but it never felt right.
Yeah.
It was one of those situations where you lock the car and you're like, you sure this is all right here?
Because I'm going to get towed.
Yeah.
It's why the Improv has always been my regular club of choice, because they have the Fred Siegel lot. I'm like, I know where I'm
behind the Improv. Yeah.
I
haven't been there in a long time. I don't know why, because I feel like
If you're getting up enough at the store,
if I'm in town and I can knock out three sets a week, four sets, I'm good.
Yeah,
I just to stay in shape. So I go in the gym. How much do I have to exercise weekly to get my comedy heart rate up?
Right. What about, I do that podcast now with Kilmartin.
I love her. I love you both. How is that thing?
It's hilarious, but it's...
What's it called?
It's called The Jackie and Laurie Show on Nerdist.
Okay.
And it is hilarious only because she wants to do three sets a night.
Yeah.
And so she's got me in this mode. of competitive, well, how many sets am I getting this week? And
what
who
are you
cares?
Guys? What are you guys? New comics?
Yeah.
Are you just starting out?
I just okay.
You
so
you just pass
the album just dropped, right?
So what's
I have,
it called?
I am not the hero of the story.
I am not the hero of the story. Jackie Cation's new album.
That's right. For the first time ever, I made all those lists.
You
I've
did?
Never even been close to making any of those, like iTunes, Amazon, Billboard, nothing.
Congratulations.
Thank you very
How
much.
How is that translating to sales, Jackie?
I have no idea. My father also lives and would like to know.
Oh, yeah.
And so I assume I'll find out from Sound Exchange 2 months from now.
Well, wait, you should set, but you're making it, people are buying it, is it on a label?
Yeah, it's on stand-up out of...
Schlissel?
Yeah, Schlissel out of
How long are you taking to put that thing together?
Oh, I write them.
Oh,
I write
good.
Them.
All right.
I'm just like, I recorded it December 26th or 28th.
Schlissel is a great champion of stand-up and,
he really
and a very sort of meticulous craftsman of the stand-up record.
Right, and sometimes bites off more than he can chew. Like, he'll take too many
sure.
projects on...
No, I've done, I think I've, he re-released one of my albums and he did two. So
right.
I know the Dan system.
Yeah.
I get those weird checks.
You get the weird checks every three or four months. Well, and I always, my whole thing with Dan is I said, I'm going to be kind of a jackass about this and because I want this to come out. Like, as far as I'm
this
concerned,
year.
It's recorded. Yes. As far as I'm concerned, it's
within
recorded.
A year of recording.
I'm done.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, just slap it together.
Yeah.
Let's cut it into tracks.
Yeah.
I've given you the art. We'll call it
well,
a
how
day.
How many shows did you record? Four?
He recorded all seven.
Oh, my God. So he did seven shows. So that's what he... See, that's biting off more than you can chew.
No. I listened to my own set five times.
Yeah.
And I really... I knew that it was probably going to be Thursday night set. And that's what it was. And then I pulled a couple of jokes that I did better on Friday first show.
Oh, you made these decisions and told him?
Entirely.
Oh, good.
I am a little OCD about my comedy. So
uh-huh.
It's my album. I'm gonna listen to my own... It's going to drive me nuts to listen to my own jokes, 5 hours of which. And then I'm going to cut them in to try... You know, essentially... I picked the tracks. I gave him time code.
Yeah.
And then he put it together and mastered it. And then he gave it back to me. And then I cut him into tracks. And then I gave it back to him. And then I gave him the art. And then I named the tracks. Immediate regret about
yeah.
some of the naming of the tracks.
Well, how'd the cover come out? That's always the tricky one that always ends up being regretful.
Right.
So you ever look at stand-up like comedy records? You're like, oof. What were
yeah.
Because I've done it too where you just do that fucking cover and you're like, this is great. And you're like, what the fuck was I thinking? Why am I wearing that hat?
I've only regretted one cover and
yeah.
it was the one that I didn't have anything to do with. Because the thing is I try not to regret anything that I sweated over
mm-hmm.
and I just let it go. I'm like, this one is called I'm Not the Hero of This Story and a woman who did a lot of fan art, but
yeah.
she's a great artist.
That's what I had ultimately. Yeah.
She did I'm dressed like Dan Frontier in front of like a Conestoga wagon.
Uh-huh. Right. So you did go with the comedy element.
I thought it was funny. That's
always the thing that bites you in the ass when you're looking back at your album covers.
Well, you remember Tim Kavanaugh?
Yeah.
Remember his headshot was him tied down with a bunch of army guys on top of him, like the Lilliputians?
I do kind of remember that.
Yeah, it's hard not to see that headshot when you're working the road.
Look at that thing in the middle.
Oh, my God. That is hilarious.
And me with the two pairs of glasses and then doing the ones on the top of my head like John
right.
Lennon. Yeah,
yeah.
That was my first headshot.
That's you should see mine had a lot of cleavage and I used to sign it on the cleavage, wish you were here.
Oh,
good
wow.
stuff. Good
sassy.
Stuff.
Sassy.
Sassy. Hilarious. Keep writing, Cation. Keep writing. Oh my God, so dumb.
So what is this your second or third record?
Fourth yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
We just keep churning them out and just sort of like, does anyone give a shit? It, like when people go like, "Who? I've never heard of you." So I've got five, six CDs.
Right. I just did a nerd cruise with like-minded individuals and so many people's like, "I've never heard, you were really funny. I've never heard of you." And I'm like, I am
and
a well-kept secret, man.
Well, they're like 12, those people.
Yeah, they're very young. They're
That's
very
what
young.
We forget. It's like, how are they going to hear it? They don't even have enough space and they haven't filled their brain up enough yet.
Right,
but
right.
They've only been exposed to a very
start new,
a narrow swash of swath of stuff.
Yeah, I recommend you start with the Bread album, Maron, and then you go to Horcrux, and then you go to this fucking thing.
Exactly.
Skip circus people. Go back if you're Jonesing. That first album, quite honestly, okay.
Which nerd cruise?
Joko, Jonathan Colton, nerd cruise, and it was
does that
amazing.
Sell out?
There was 1,780 people.
On a boat.
On a ship. This is the first year that they rented the whole ship.
Mm.
Previously, they were just part of a ship, and then they'd huddle up, like, and it was cozy. I guess it was cozier for nerds. They were like, oh, there's people who just like cruises. I'm going to go hang out with someone who just likes science
fiction. How long?
7 days.
Oh, I can't. I get
plenty
nauseous.
Plenty places to hide. And, wait a minute, I should show you this.
All right.
They gave us these buttons, and the buttons said, yes, I can do friendship right now, or no, I can't do friendship right now.
Friendship.
Friendship. Like, don't fucking talk to me, or you can talk to me.
It's helpful for nerds, I guess.
It's real helpful, I think, for all humanity.
Oh, there you go. No, I do not want to do the friendship right now. Oh, what's the other one say? Yes, I do want to do friendship right now. Is this code for...
For
know,
anything?
For, you know...
It's code for nothing. For bowl of keys? No, it's not code
no,
for anything.
No, oh, it's not.
It's a, yeah, no, it's not going to get any...
It's just a cute any, thing.
It's a cute thing, and it's also a, seriously, I'm on the spectrum. Leave me the fuck alone.
And, that's a better button.
Maybe next year.
Seriously, I'm on the spectrum. Leave me the fuck alone.
Where's that t-shirt?
That's a button. That's the best one I've heard. So Jonathan's a musical actor. There's
yeah,
more?
Yeah. You know, he wrote.
No,
the,
people love him.
People love him. He came to.
I don't know enough. Well, I like the guy. I met him a few times.
Right, nice guy. Yeah. And he's essentially like if Weird Al didn't write parodies, mm-hmm. or if They Might Be Giants were silly, because he wrote the final song "Still Alive" in the video game Portal.
Okay,
those are all words that's that
his
you
big,
know.
That was his big break.
That was his break. He wrote a song at the end of a video game.
Yeah,
but it was Portal, and yeah. Portal is huge.
Okay,
so.
Well, so that's well, you got to get it where you can.
Well, that's it.
And who are the other comics on that?
It was Aparna and Cherla.
Yeah,
Cameron and Rhea,
mm-hmm.
Cameron Esposito and Rhea Butcher, and then Janet Varney, and a bunch of improv people.
Oh,
like
wow.
Al Lublin, and
so a lot of entertainment options. A
lot of entertainment options, and then the Double Clicks were music acts. They're sisters
mm-hmm.
out of Portland, essentially. Like if Garfunkel and Oates were nerdier.
Oh, wow.
So if you think of like Aisha Tyler,
yeah.
who looks like a supermodel, but is constantly playing massive multiplayer online
yeah. Yeah,
games.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that's true. You know, that there can be a hidden nerd complex.
Does she just look like a supermodel or was she a supermodel?
I don't know what her whole story is. I've never done a long interview with her. I should probably do that at some point.
Yeah, she's awesome.
You know, it's like it gets away from me. You know, I reach out to a lot of people. It doesn't happen. And then some people I'm like, oh, shit, I should just, you know, why haven't I talked to them yet? You know, yeah. Your life just keeps going.
Right. Well, on and on. It's,
yeah.
The Dork Forest is nothing like that, but it's like that. You
yeah.
know? And just because it's.
And that's still weekly?
Still weekly.
Yeah.
I recorded 6 on the Nerd Cruise, as you can well imagine.
Why not?
I could have recorded 1,780.
Get some in the can.
That's
yeah.
It, that's it. And then I just have 3 months off.
It's now, is there a lot of food on the boat? That's what I remember about the one cruise I was on. It's like a bell rings
it's
and you
terrifying.
Eat.
It's terrifying. It's that was my greatest fear. It
the
wasn't
food.
The booze. It wasn't like
the ongoing
the
buffet.
It was the ongoing buffet.
Yeah.
I dealt with it okay,
yeah.
but not great. Not great.
It's very hard.
Every day with the ice cream cation?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
not cool.
Well, that's the same being on set. You're like, what the fuck is that dessert?
Exactly. Why is that here?
That's not something you can eat every day.
That's why
I'm going to eat it every day I'm here.
Because it's finite. It's going to be over any minute.
And also I have this weird thing where it's like, you just can't leave that food out. What? Someone's got to eat it.
I have that too.
I got to help out.
Exactly. We don't want it to go to waste.
Yeah.
Oh.
So are you on Maria's show?
I'm doing a bit part, sort of like I did on yours.
Yeah.
I have a bit part next week I'm recording with.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you on the first season?
Yeah. They cut me though. It was, I did the episode with
How'd
Andy
that go
Kindler.
Over? Did they cut Andy?
They cut Andy as well.
Oof.
But do you know why? Because I don't know if you've seen it. I've only seen the first 3 episodes myself.
Really?
Do you know why?
Isn't that weird?
Because I'm in the 4th episode.
Right.
And And it's funny, because you know who it is. It's Lady Dynamite, right?
Yeah.
Is Maria's show. And it's Arrested Development, South Park, and yeah. Maria Bamford's act all shoved into a blender.
Right.
So it's filthy, weird, and genius
yeah.
all in a glurg. And so there's so many layers to it that I was not surprised that they cut. Essentially, it was she and I discussing dick jokes,
yeah.
I think. It was like, there was...
Well, I love her, and I want to watch the show, and I had Fred in here, Melmed.
Okay.
And
he's great.
He's great. I talked to Andy a lot, but I don't know where people find the time. I don't know what I'm doing with my time.
Right. What you watch things. Yeah.
You know, I've just got to sit down and lock in, and it's got to catch me. It's got to grab me.
I'm rereading some bullshit. That's what I'm doing. I'm stopping the voices in my head. That's what I'm doing.
What are you reading?
Right now, I'm rereading Lois McMaster Bujold's space opera, The Vorkosigan Saga.
Really?
Yeah, all of those are words.
I don't know what you just said.
Those are all just words. It's science fiction, and it's this woman out of Minneapolis who wrote these great this great space opera, and she's great. It's one of my favorite lines is lead character Cordelia, whatever, from Beta.
Yeah.
Beta colony, technological colony.
Yeah.
Like super tech.
Right.
Fella that they end up getting together from a super patriarchal military colony called Barriere. They get married. That guy becomes the regent. It becomes space opera and political drama.
Sure.
Because he becomes the regent to the young king, right?
Yeah.
And at one point, they're at a party, and she's from this uber-liberal tech colony, and one of his political enemies comes up to her and says, well, you know, Errol's bisexual. And she goes, sure, but he's monogamous right now.
This is her husband?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the guy's like, phew! Like, he tried to blow up their marriage by alerting her that he was bisexual, and she's like... Yeah, I know. He used to be with a fella.
Yeah. Did she know that?
She had known it.
Oh.
So
that failed.
It failed so much. I mean, I don't know. If it were a surprise, like if you were with somebody and you found out after you had married them or been with them for years that they had a relationship with the same sex, would it freak you out?
No, it's happened.
Right. You just go, well,
you're sort of like, wait, what?
Okay. That's exactly how I responded. I dated this one guy who told me that he used to date guys in Germany
because
they give
specific.
Him free. He was German for sweaters. I'd get a real nice jumper out of it, and I was like, "Is that prostitution? What were you doing?"
Well, that adds another element to it.
It was
the guys blowing guys for sweaters.
It felt like a whole other level.
It's one thing to have a relationship, but if it's just about the sweaters, yeah. That guy's
genuinely, it did make it uncomfortable. I was like, well, we will not be dating more than this then. I mean, that was the only time
where
it really...
Is that one of the sweaters?
Right. Yeah. How about that one? That seems a nice cashmere.
Well, I like that the idea that the one thing that's interesting, it seems to me, about that science fiction story is that the human thing hasn't shifted. Like that, you know, I like stories that honor that. Like, you know, when you start to realize, like, humans in the form they're in now have been around for however long they've been around and haven't changed much.
No.
And they might not.
Right. The committee meeting is still the worst in everybody's head.
That seems like a nice grounded sci-fi story.
It's pretty great.
Well, good luck
Thanks
with
for
the record.
Me. Yeah.
I am not the hero of this story. Jackie Cation's new CD and download, and you've got the one you do with Kilmartin.
Yeah, Jackie and Laurie Show.
And you've got the Dork Forest.
Yep, which if you got time, come back on and talk about something that isn't blue jeans.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, I'll come
back. Maybe cats.
I'll come back on. Yeah,
I'd
come
love
back.
It.
Sure. And then also episode 4 of the first season of Lady Dynamite.
Yeah, exactly. And an where they cut all my lines, but I'm pictured. And
are you touring?
Like a crazy person.
Really?
Yeah,
just all around? What's the website?
JackieCation.com. You can go to FamilyPetAncestry.com because it points to that because it made me laugh. Don't you want to know if your cat came over on the Mayflower? Don't you want to know if your dog's
I'd love
eligible?
To know where my new kitten comes from because he's got Egyptian. He's got an Egyptian head.
See?
Yeah.
You're like, oh.
Abyssinian something. Like he's exotic. Like a genius cat. It's funny. I guess people do that with kids too. Like this one's special. I mean, look at its ears.
Right. Yeah. So I do that joke about dogs of the American Revolution, right? Uh-huh. Having your dog join the DAR. Some guy emailed me. I did the joke on Conan. Guy emails me. He's like, my cat is actually a direct descendant of Truman's cat.
Oh, that's funny.
And I was like, are you kidding? I hope there's half of me that hopes he's kidding, and there's half of me that's like, how did you do that? How did you trace it?
Well, I mean, depending where he lives and what you know, I mean, I think like because if you go down to Key West, there's all those Hemingway cats, those six-fingered Hemingway cats.
Oh, right, then you could actually get a Hemingway cat if you wanted.
Well,
one.
Yeah, but they're just all over the place.
Yeah,
and they are from the original six-fingered cat. It's easy to identify. They got,
right? Yeah. Yeah, that is a mutant cat. So.
Well, it's great seeing you. I love talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Jackie Cation. I'm Not the Hero of This Story is out now. Listen to her podcasts, Dork Forest or The Jackie and Laurie Show. So having your mind blown by a book is one of the great experiences of being human. So do that occasionally. It does, sometimes it's hard to find the books that are going to blow your fucking mind. But they're out there, right? This Paul Beatty book, The Sellout, was astounding, and I was excited to get an opportunity to talk to him. What I'm saying is The Sellout by Paul Beatty is a hilarious book, like, and you can't really put it down, and it's deep and layered and funny and dark and light and just brilliant. It won the prestigious Man Booker Prize for Fiction last year, and it's now available in paperback. And this is me talking to the author of that book, Paul Beatty. All right, so you were in Boston, and you went to BU.
I did.
But we were at BU at the same time. You would have been a year ahead of me.
Absolutely.
In the English department.
No.
Oh.
Psych.
You were in the psych department.
Mm.
Well, and you knew we had common friends, maybe?
We knew Sue Silverman.
Sarah's sister, Sue,
yeah.
Dated a guy I knew briefly.
Who was that?
A guy named Steve Brill. He's a film director. And I remember meeting Laura Silverman with Sue in a ski jacket. But I don't know, what was Sue studying?
Sue was doing psych.
She was?
Yeah.
Now, what compelled you to do psych?
I don't know. My friends tell me I always said I wanted to be a psychologist.
Yeah.
So what compelled me, I have no idea. But it was the right call at the right time, I think.
Yeah? Do you find that the stuff that you learn there is useful still?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah, really. It really helped shape how I see things, how I see people, you know, how I see myself. And it really made me aware that there's so much going on at any given time.
Uh-huh.
You know? And part of it is, you know, what you're paying attention to and what you're listening to and how you're listening, you know, there's just so much happening.
How is your brain getting fucked and how are you reacting to it?
Yeah, you know, and
what are you bringing to the table?
That's exactly it. You know, aware that everybody's putting their baggage on the table.
Right.
You know? Size of the luggage, and you know, there's just so much happening.
I know, and things happen in a moment that could have implications and repercussions that go on for a lifetime.
You know, I teach.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, when I was in school, I did something called small group processes.
Yeah,
you know, you just put in a room, and it was kind of very counterculture for BU, especially at that time.
You
know, we drink wine, and you know, just anyways. But, you know, we had these phrases. I had a beautiful professor there, this guy, Bob Chin, who I've learned a ton from.
What did he teach?
Yeah, he taught psych and social psych. You know, he had these phrases, the here and now, listen to yourself, listen.
Yeah.
You know, all these things that just help you gauge where you are all the time.
Right,
right. You know, my friends would, anyways, it's just, and it's stuff that I try to instill in my students because it's helped me.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
About seeing the layering, seeing the depth, seeing the complicated shit and the simple, you know.
And you teach writing?
Yeah.
Where at?
At Columbia.
So when you're at BU, you graduated with a psychology degree?
I did.
And where'd you go to grad school?
At BU.
You did?
I did.
For psychology?
I did.
You went the full run.
Yeah, man, it was a mistake in some ways, you know, but you know, I applied to go to these other places, Michigan and all these places. I think I was going to end up at University of Chicago.
What was the plan?
I didn't really have a plan. You know, it was the one thing that, you know, kind of captivated me at some level, you know, I had some interest in. And the plan was, I guess at the time I would have done that. And, you know, you get these organizational behavioral jobs at Kodak or something. I don't know what these companies were.
Really?
You run these workshops and
So it was sort of
things.
You were going to, there was a career there, of a consultant career.
Yeah, that's the word.
Do office hours career.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I wasn't thinking about teaching.
Well, you grew up around here?
Not around here so much, but, you know, West LA, I guess.
Like how far west?
I grew up in Santa Monica and Venice, and then we moved to like right off Robertson Boulevard and Beverlywood.
And what was the childhood? What was your old man in?
I didn't really never knew my father.
Oh yeah,
you know, him and my mom got divorced when I was three, I guess.
Three.
Yeah.
And that was it. He was out?
Yeah, he was out. Yeah, he was out.
So it was just you and your mom?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Me and my mom, my two sisters.
Got two sisters.
Yeah.
Same dad?
Same father.
Yeah. He just split on everybody.
Yeah, he didn't split. My mom, she left him, I guess.
Okay.
You know, or I don't know exactly what happened, but, you know, they got divorced.
Yeah.
He didn't, you know, go smoke a cigarette or anything.
Right. And you guys just, you grew up in that part of town?
We did.
Are the sisters older?
We're all more or less the same age, but they're younger than me.
Yeah,
we're all like
within
9 months
of years.
Apart. Yeah,
oh, really?
Something like that.
So. And what'd they get involved in?
My sister Sharon she writes plays every now and then. She teaches. My sister Anna works for DWP, you know, Department of Water and Power.
So when you were coming up, you know, when you were going to high school and shit, what do you think compelled you to this, research of the human brain?
It's just from reading. You know, we didn't have a television.
No?
No.
On purpose?
I guess so. But we just never had a television, like, for very spare moments.
Yeah.
But, you know, for most of the time growing up, we never had a television. So my mom just had a library and just, you know, all of us just read all of it.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah, what was, like,
she had
what?
Good taste, thankfully. So,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
Like, what were you getting?
Oh, we got Heller, we got Bellow, we got Updike. You know, we got a ton of shit.
And, really?
Yeah, my mom's an artist. And so we just a whole broad of stuff.
So it was like sort of like she was a creative person interested in that.
Absolutely. She's interested in everything. So,
she a painter?
Yes, she is. And she's smart as fuck. I mean, my mom's insanely smart. So it's...
What was the guidance? Was she obviously encouraging to creative life?
Yeah, she didn't... She never encouraged, but she never discouraged.
Right.
You know, so she never... She didn't tell us much. You know, we didn't have a ton of rules.
Yeah.
We never had curfew or anything. So she didn't tell us much, but everything was there. And
yeah.
She just kind of dragged us to places, you know? And so...
art openings.
Yeah, and just never censored us. So, you know, we'd gone to all these movies, you know, since forever.
Did she engage you on them?
Yeah, because I think, you know, we're not very talkative,
mm-hmm.
but amongst us, we're very talkative. And, you know,
right.
all of us have our little theories about shit. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, we talk about this stuff.
Because I know in the book, The Sellout, that, like, there is, you know, the thing is just infused, just, you know, outside of the story.
Yeah.
The thing is infused with, you know, a depth of sort of cultural criticism,
yeah.
intellectual assessments of film theory,
yeah.
You know, semantics.
Yeah.
That it's interesting because all through it, all the characters seem at moments, you know, incredibly informed and sophisticated intellectually.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think they don't make many distinguished... They're not very judgmental about it. There's shit that they like and there's shit that they don't. But
yeah.
it's not like they like highbrow, they like lowbrow. It's all fused.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's
you
all
know?
Fused.
Yeah.
That you have like sort of like, you know, like street dialogue, but then all of a sudden out of nowhere, you know, you've got Truffaut references.
Yeah, I mean, it's just language, man. It's just language. Yeah.
It's just language, but it's thought.
Yo, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So when you didn't start, I mean, this is your second novel or third novel?
My fourth.
Fourth. But you started, like, the other place I think we could have crossed paths, but maybe not, maybe on the street, was I was on the Lower East Side from, like, 87, 88
yeah.
to like 92, 93.
Okay.
I was on second between A and B.
Okay. Yeah, that's where I live. I live on second, you know.
Now?
Between B and C. So like, you saw the all the drug stuff.
I saw, the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it was before Giuliani had taken over and there was a lot of, there was a lot of drugs on the street. That was it. That
the
was
world,
the street.
Save the Robots.
Yes. Right around the corner.
Yeah.
I
absolutely.
Never went to that shit, but I was trying to not do drugs. So.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of the behavior.
Yeah.
There was a doorway next to my house.
Oh, I know where you live then. You lived on... Yeah, I know exactly where you live.
Like, there was this weird...
Just have that line outside.
Exactly.
I know exactly where you
live. Yeah, there was a line outside that doorway, and next to it was this weird garage full of cans. There was, like, this garage... I don't know what was going on there, but they were just moving recyclables in and out of a little Latino guy.
Yeah, the garage is still there. It's like a beer... distributorship
exactly.
or something like that. Yeah.
Right now, but there's a restaurant right there, too.
There is.
Like an Italian restaurant.
Yeah, that's been there for a while.
Yeah, dude, when I was there, it was like insanity.
Yeah.
It was just...
I mean, you go to New York, so you know. But so I didn't live there. I didn't get down there till like 90, maybe. I was living in East Harlem, And I did like 6 months in Brooklyn for a while when I first got to New York.
Before Brooklyn was Brooklyn.
Mm, I was deep in Brooklyn. I was in Midwood. So, yeah. Yeah.
So, but you know, you were at the New Eurekan?
Yeah, I would read at the New Eurekan. I'd read there. I'd read at St. Mark's Poetry Project, you know.
But it was poetry.
Yeah, it was.
And what was it that, because like at that time, it seemed to me that that slam poetry thing, that New Eurekan, that I knew guys who were, you know, innately funny, that there was a stand-up element to some of it, I felt.
Yeah.
Like, I knew a guy who was a stand-up that actually went into it.
Yeah.
Because it seemed to give him more freedom than comedy.
Yeah.
What was your...
I was just reading. You know, I'm not very performative.
Really? You were just reading?
I just read. You know, I just read. I mean, especially when the place first opened, you know, there were a lot of disgruntled poets, you know, and that felt shut out of like St. Mark's. I don't know these poetry wars, but
there are though,
yeah,
right?
There was. I mean, there war isn't anything. Yeah. So, you know, and it was just an open place. It was nice. You know, Creeley would be there. Just a ton of people would be there.
So, Bob Creeley was there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did he pass away?
He did.
Mm-hmm.
He did. And so, so for me, it was just New York had a scene. New Eurekan had its own thing. You could drink and talk shit and, you know,
right.
It was fun. But I mean, I think like really early on, had a friend of mine saying, yeah, you know, they're going to have velvet ropes out here very soon. Like, you could see that happening.
To the poetry scene.
Yeah, and it became, you know, the thing I realized, I was just writing, you know, and it's nothing wrong with it, but like your friend, he's a stand-up. It was so performative and so all these other things.
Yeah, and then MTV got hold of it, like Maggie Estep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was doing it. They were adding music to it sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, nothing wrong with that, but that was me.
You were more of a purist?
Not a purist. I just read. You know, I'm kind of shy. I look down and I just read. You know? And for me, I think it's important for let the page, the words do all the work, you know?
Right.
And let that do the selling, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
and so the other stuff, I'm just uncomfortable doing it. So,
but so you're like, in terms of reading poetry out loud, yeah, the words got to do it, but the pauses got to do it.
Yeah, I kind of just blurted through it. Like, I was so uncomfortable, you know.
Why'd you do it?
Because I think it was part of the job, you know, and like
being a poet.
Yeah, yeah. And so I remember when I first got to New York and trying to figure out how to write, I saw Poets Magazine, some magazine.
After you
this
finished
is like,
graduate
this,
school.
So I didn't finish grad school. So like midway through, I did my third year and I was like not studying for my qualifying exams. Yeah. And I was just like, yeah, I really don't want to do this, you know? And I was talking to my friend, Ruth Saad, actually. I don't know if you knew Ruth. I think
didn't.
It's possible that you guys, okay.
Maybe.
Yeah. Anyways, we were just walking down, I think we're on Beacon. And I just remember saying to her one day, you know what? I think I want to write. And it just clicked. And I was like, yeah, I'm out, you know? And it was a good thing.
And you hadn't written?
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really. But like, I think I had this slow thing about how much I enjoyed writing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was slow, you know? And the thing was, you know, I mean, the good thing about Boston had all those great used bookstores and these great used record stores, you know? And, I was just reading everything I wasn't supposed to be reading, you know? And
like what?
Oh, man. Just, there was a bookstore. I think it was on Beacon. So I would just dive in there, man, and E.E. Cummins, reading all this shit, you know?
E.E. Cummins, yeah,
all this
yeah.
kind of stuff.
And the Beats play a part?
No, not then so much. I mean, I had read Ginsberg and Kerouac a little bit, you know? And I'm aware of it and stuff. But that stuff came more into my sensibilities when I moved to New York.
Yeah.
You know, and Alan was my teacher for a while.
Alan?
Yeah, Ginsberg.
Really?
Yeah. And so...
Where?
At Brooklyn College. Yeah, when I left BU, I just went to Brooklyn College and got my MFA. I didn't know how you were supposed to do it. And at the time, there might have been 20, 25 places where you got your MFA writing or something. So I was either going to come back to California or go to New York. And so ended up getting in Brooklyn College. And so I showed up kind of never having written anything, except for these little poems I kind of squealed out, you know, to send for the application.
And so how'd you get in?
I have no idea, you know, who knows, you know, who knows.
And Alan was there towards the end of his life, was he?
No, it wasn't quite towards the end. I mean, he was up there, but so this is, you know, late 80s, I
uh-huh,
guess.
Uh-huh.
So.
Wow, that must be like, because, you know, he's one of these guys that I sort of have I mythologized the Beats
right.
when I was younger.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I had Alan's books, and I've got a lot of the little... the ones that he wrote in the big collection. And he, what was he like as a teacher?
He was very gracious.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah, he was very gracious. He was like, he, you know, opened his doors and he told really good stories.
Yeah.
And
he certainly had him.
Yeah. And
what did you learn from him?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing I really learned from Alan is precision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was so big on clarity and precision and editing and wasted breath and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, I learned a lot and not so much from him, but a thing that I sort of got at Brooklyn, like these basic things.
Yeah.
Which was like, you kind of have to be fearless a little bit, you know?
In terms of exposing yourself or what?
It's your choice.
Right.
For me, it was just not censoring myself, you know?
Right.
Not like a very...
taking a risk.
Personal writer.
Right.
You know, I don't talk about myself very much, you know? And even though what I write is very personal,
yeah,
it's not so much about me necessarily.
Yeah.
Know? But, yeah, you know, just... Yeah, I had another teacher there, Tucker Farley, who was she was nuts, but she really just pushed, you know, how we think. And I had another guy, Lou Asikoff, who was, you know, close with Alan, who really encouraged me. Because when I was there, after the first year, the professor told me to stop writing. You know, I got like a C+ in poetry.
Really?
Yeah. We sat down. She was like, yeah, I really think this isn't for you. And
really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so... But thank goodness I had a guy who I'm still very close with today, this Professor Lou Asikoff, who we used to meet with, you know, once a week for an hour and so and read my poems alongside me. You know, so I told Lou, I guess I'm quitting. You know, I guess I suck, you know. And Lou was like, he was beautiful, man. He was, he told me, you're doing something that no one else is doing. You know, you're on to something.
Really?
Yeah. It was so helpful. I can't tell you how helpful he was to me. And he told me a thing that really slowed me down, which was people are going to learn how to read you. Because I'd been struggling with this. You know, what am I supposed to do? What language? You know, how, like all these things that you talked about before. Like
yeah.
This fusion of language.
Yeah.
You know, who needs to understand what and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
I'm really struggling with that. And so Lou told me, yeah, people are going to learn to read you.
Yeah.
You know, don't listen to her. Just come back and keep it going. And it's funny because at the end of that year, I'd written a poem. Finally a poem that I was like, yeah, I kind of like this.
Yeah.
You know? And there was a kid in the class and I remember reading that poem and the kid was like, this, I don't understand this. I don't get it. Blah, blah, blah. This doesn't make any sense. None of this is the worst poem I've ever read. You know?
Oh,
and then so that next year, we had Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah.
And so Ginsberg, we had the same class, just different teacher.
Right.
And Ginsberg comes in, he goes, let's start from the top. Bring in your best poem. We're going to start from there. So I brought up that poem. It was my best poem.
Yeah.
And I read that same poem.
Yeah.
And that same kid was like, oh, Paul's a genius. This is an allusion to this. This is a reference, you know, this whole thing. And I had been really struggling about like, what words kind of, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I was just like flat. I mean, I didn't have to say anything. Like he pretty much got it in the way that he got it. And I remember asking him after class, I said, dude, what happened, man? You hated that poem.
Yeah.
And he just was like, you know, I spent 3 months in New York, you know, over the summer.
Uh-huh.
And it just said, opened his head, opened his ears, opened his eyes.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And but for me, it wasn't like, yeah, whatever I do is good. But it was this thing of just, you know, there's so much happening. You know, all this is shifting.
Right.
You know? And it's like something, you know, that you learn in psych about like, everyone's in a different place at the different time. You know, there's just so much movement.
Right.
In terms of your political awareness, in terms of everybody's just in different places. You know?
Yeah, you can always get your mind blown.
Yeah, yeah. And you can always blow back, you know. It just, you know, I think people think of this consciousness as this progression somehow, you know.
And also poetry, I think, as a form is something that it does grow with you, you know, that you can read a poem and be completely outside of it.
Yeah.
And then years later, come back to it and have a completely different experience with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's
it.
Like anything. That's like a good joke. That's like anything.
Sure.
You know, so good painting, you know, it's...
That's
you
right.
change, you know?
Yeah. Well, jokes are a little more descriptive. Like, you know, I mean, you might not think something's funny, but like... Right. I mean, I get what you're saying about a turn of phrase or a joke, but like sometimes poems have a code to them. Jokes are not that coded.
You don't think so? What do you mean by code, I guess?
Well, I mean that, you know, a joke, you know, in and of itself, like a story or a joke,
sure.
unless it's some sort of Hasidic tale that has a cryptic ending, you know, you should at least know the structure of like, you know, that's where the funny is, And if I'm not getting the funny, it usually means it's because you don't know something.
Yeah, yeah, but that's the same with the, I guess think that's so. The same.
Okay.
You know, it's like,
okay.
Again, it's that baggage. Yeah. You know, like,
I
what do you
so.
Bring it to it?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Know? So
what did Alan think of that poem?
Yeah, I think Alan liked it. I mean, I think Alan, he saw something in me, I hope. You know, I think, you know, I kind of can romanticize all this stuff, but he did a nice thing with. Is he did this speaking series,
yeah,
where he brought in all these black male poets.
Yeah.
I think I was kind of the only black kid in poetry.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I was.
Yeah.
But anyway, he brought in these guys, Quincy Troop, Amiri Baraka,
yeah,
Southern Cat, Kofi Natambu. And those were guys, it was fun to listen to. Like, I didn't agree with hardly anything they said, but it was really interesting to hear them talk about their processes and how they thought, just where they're fit in that world.
Like, what do you mean didn't agree with
that? Yeah. So I remember one guy, you know, Alan, because, you know, Alan brings all this environmental stuff to the table.
Sure.
He brought so much stuff to the table. So I remember him talking to Quincy about just the world, just the physical environment. And I remember Quincy going, yeah, that's your problem. You know, I just was like, whoa, that's so weird. You know, there's a lot of stuff,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And, but it was really refreshing for me, you know? And, I just opened my head up a little bit.
But was that the first time you really came in contact with black poets?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I didn't know too many people that wrote outside of school.
Yeah.
So, like Amir would invite me to his things. They weren't for me, you know.
Right.
But
why?
It just they weren't. I'm not a group person.
Right.
So
yeah.
I'm not an ideologue like that. You know,
right.
I'm not like writing is fighting necessarily. It might be, but I don't think of it that way. You know.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. So that just stuff. But you know. But I respect the intellect. You
yeah.
know. I've learned so much from Amir over. He's a really good writer. And
yeah.
And those guys were open. You know, Quincy really helped me. It's funny now I think about that because I guess that's where I met Quincy. Quincy gave me all these fucking great readings back in the day that, you know, I didn't know you could make $5,000 for reading some poems, you know, in 1995. You know, I didn't know you could do that. You know,
right.
So Quincy was really helpful in that kind of stuff. And just, you know, good guys,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
willing
sure.
to share. And
sure.
stuff. So, yeah.
And it's very specific and it's a creative endeavor. You know, like poetry. I mean, yeah, they're good guys, but I mean, it's like, it's not a huge world.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely you know, not. Which was good for me at the time. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
And when did you read, like, because at the end of the book, you know, you, I mean, like, I'm not well versed in much of anything. It's all sort of random. But, you know, you do, you go out of your way to talk about William E. Cross Jr.'s piece.
Yeah.
The Negro to Black conversion experience in Black World 20, July 1971.
Yeah, yeah. I read that in grad school. Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah.
Well, what would, when you were in grad school, when you were an undergrad, you know, when you talk about baggage or you talk about, you know, personal baggage or growing into it, how much were you involved in educating yourself about race?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think different places at different times,
uh-huh.
you know, so, you know, I kind of tend to hang out with who's ever close, you know, proximity. It doesn't matter who they are. They're
yeah,
nearby. I'm kind of lazy. So,
yeah.
you know, if you're in that sphere, then we're going to hang out, you
right.
know, or attempt to at least. So, you know, I had a crew of kids, you know, this kind of lived on my floor.
Yeah.
You know, and then,
when you were a kid.
No, at BU.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and same when I was a kid, you know, I hung out with the kids on the block.
Right.
So, yeah, for the most part. But I had other friends, I guess through my mom and stuff. But, you know, so the race thing is always there. It's, you know, it's everything's always everywhere. So that was always there. But, you know, for the most part of undergrad, most of my friends were white, I guess, you know, except cats that I played basketball with. I used to referee games and stuff, like intramural games. So you
uh-huh.
met a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I don't know if you remember all this, but like, you know, all the divestiture movement out of South Africa and stuff. I don't know if you remember
with
all
Fred,
this.
With Silber, you know, that,
yeah,
that he
Silber,
had invested. Right,
and,
there was protests.
Zinn was a part of all these movements.
That's right.
And you remember
Howard
all
Zinn.
This? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just lived on the periphery of that kind of stuff.
Leading those protests
yeah.
against. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah, it's not like, you know, then I had another professor at BU, Althea Smith, who was... she's one of the few black professors that I had there, but who was, you know, really doing interesting research and stuff around race and all this. It's always kind of cool for me to just think about this stuff.
Yeah.
And then so, like, you know, the thing I was like, you know, at the time, I guess people would say, oh, racism. And I just was like, what does that mean? You know,
yeah.
like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
And then so I was like trying to like come up with a scale, like this kind of Richter scale of racism. You know, yeah. That's a 7.5. You know, because I was trying to, because we use that word to mean so much, and it's, and I don't know how you measure these things.
Yeah.
And it's not like, you know, like, I don't know. That's the best I can do is come up with this Richter scale of racism.
So in the sense of measuring, it mean like, you know, what is essentially hatred and what is essentially ignorance and what is essentially impolite or what?
Yeah, not that. Like, in just in terms of impact.
Yeah.
So
on you.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. I remember I used to work at Trader Joe's. And I always remember working at Trader Joe's.
Where?
Nashville and Westwood. It's right near the house. So,
like
yeah.
One of the early Trader Joe's?
Yeah, Trader Joe's. I think it's Trader Joe's number 7. This is when there were no Trader
right.
Joe's.
I remember that.
A long time ago. So, yeah. Yeah.
So you worked there.
Yeah. And I remember, I don't know, doing the icebox or whatever. And I remember a black woman coming in the store and the white kid I was working with going, "Hey, do you think she's pretty?" I just went, wait a minute. That was just so weird for me.
Yeah.
Like, why is he asking me that? You know,
yeah, yeah.
Is that race? You know, I didn't know what it was necessarily, you know, but it's like all these little things, you know, I'm just.
And how did you judge that?
How did I judge that from him? He was one of the kids who I actually didn't know very well.
Uh-huh.
But so I'm like, you know, then I don't know. I must have been 18, 19 or uh-huh. something. I don't know how old I was. And I was like, well, you know, people come in there all the time,
yeah.
And you never go, hey, is she this?
Yeah.
You know, you just tell me you think she's that.
Right.
It's like, you know, what is that about? Like, what are you, you know?
That switch.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing.
And this is before any psychology.
Yeah,
yeah,
I guess so. Or very early on in that. And
yeah.
all these, just a ton of little things.
Uh-huh.
And not so little sometimes.
Yeah.
But just trying to figure out, like, where's this definite, I mean, it's these things, all these words that I never know what they mean. I never know.
Like, what are some other ones?
Satire, pride, yeah. All these kind of things, you
yeah.
know. I don't know what these words mean. You know, I know what they mean in the context.
Yeah.
But they're so fuzzy for me.
Satire is kind of fuzzy.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, when people use these words,
yeah.
You know, like, are they self-serving? Are you using them as shields? Are they, you know, it's just...
Where does pride come into
it? Yeah, so pride's like one of the things. I mean, I lived in Germany for a while.
Really? Where?
In Berlin.
What year was that?
That was like 96, 97.
Huh.
Yeah.
What brought you there?
Didn't have any money, so I went to Berlin. Had a beautiful... It was fine.
How long?
About a year and a half, I guess.
Really?
Maybe a little bit less.
Uh-huh.
That
must have been interesting.
Yeah, it was. I didn't go outside very much.
Didn't engage with
no,
the culture?
No, I was going through a lot of stuff personally, and just I had a hard time there being stared at, being dragged around.
Well, like, were you depressed?
I'm always depressed, so, you know, that goes without saying.
Really?
Yeah. I just, my first novel had come out. Like, there was a bunch of stuff going on. And I just hadn't had any friends I had met, like, in a really organic way.
Right.
Anyways. So, you know, I just listened to them talk. Everyone's so goddamn smart there. And I remember people saying, you know, they weren't allowed to say, "I'm proud to be German." And I was like, oh, wow, that's wild. You know, it's, like, almost illegal to say that.
Really?
Yeah, because, like, what does that mean? You know?
Yeah.
And it just made me think about this black pride, all this kind of shit that I don't know what that means. Like, is that like a constant, or are you allowed to be proud for just 5 seconds? And then the other, you know, 5 seconds, you don't give a fuck. And what are the things that you feel are black embarrassments or German embarrassings? Like, how does, like, what's the equation? Like, where's this, how does this pride needle work? You know?
Well, I guess when it's right. I understand what you're saying. And I think that when it's used in that broad sense, that it is about, kind of strengthening or diminishing an identity.
Yeah, or, you know, I mean, I understand, like, the need to self-affirm like that sometimes. But, you know, that also comes with a cost. And it also comes with this kind of hierarchical kind of sense, you know?
How do you mean?
You know, so I'm African-American. If I have black pride, whatever that is, what does that do for you as a white person, or you as a California pride? You know, like, how do all these prides work together? Because you're just not just one thing. There's just so much shit happening.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. It's a loaded and broad idea.
Yeah. And so this is not going to make any sense, but I remember being on ComAv once and with a bunch of black kids, and there was something happening. These two kids got into a fight. And there was this kid, and he was like, "Oh, I'm so embarrassed as a black person." And I just remember looking at him going, "Wait, why are you embarrassed? This has nothing to do with you." But this weird kind of collective thing.
Yeah.
That I don't know how to process it.
Right.
You know? So,
well, what was the fight? Was it within the group you were with? Or
Were just two people, you know, doing something, and he felt embarrassed as a black guy because two other black people were doing something that he was embarrassed by. I didn't understand that.
Oh, that we're all representing.
Yeah. I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, I saw this documentary about like the Oi movement in the UK.
Yeah.
And this skinhead guy's talking. And they're like, well, what appealed to you about the movement? And he goes, yeah, you know, I had an embarrassment about being working class. And that music, that scene, and he wanted to say pride, and then he stopped himself because he went, no, it's not about pride, but I just wasn't embarrassed about it anymore. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly it.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, that's exactly it. And for me, there's a distinction there somehow.
Yeah.
You know?
What was the Oi movement?
That's just skinhead music, you know, punk music.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Just, you know, this kind of thing.
Which has offshoots and
yeah,
sort of evolved.
Some nationalistic offshoots. It just has some kind of music. It has some alternative. It has a ton of offshoots.
That's interesting. Not be embarrassed.
Just not being embarrassed.
And shameless in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like he was talking about like how he would be embarrassed about telling people where he was from and all this kind of thing. And then at some point, he just kind of didn't give a fuck. You know, but it wasn't about necessarily having pride in being from the place, but not being embarrassed about it. That's an interesting distinction for me.
Well, it's interesting that you glean that information, that what delivered the goods in terms of how to wrap your brain around some element of pride was, you know, delivered by, you know, something that is really identified as a nationalistic, you know, somewhat white supremacist movement.
Yeah. I mean, but like in Germany, I had many friends who would say these things, but there was interesting ways that sometimes made me uncomfortable for whatever reason, about that they did show their national pride.
Yeah.
You know, might not be flag waving then, but there were things. Hey, I'm not allowed to say this, but X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't really, and then, you know, there were still like, you know, the wall had just really been down. And so there was this interesting thing about what German pride was. You know, I had some East German friends, what their, I'm going to use the word pride in being East German, but you know, this, how these identities shift and how quickly identity gets created. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And just at the time, you know, I wrote a bunch of stuff about it, but like at the time it reminded me a lot about what I had read about, you know, the Reconstruction era here in the States.
Yeah.
You know, in African-Americanness and Germanness, I don't know. There was just a lot of similarities for me, really.
Really?
Yeah.
In terms of the identification of genocide.
Yeah, yeah,
and having no real way out of not being identified with that, and the Reconstruction and the black community being identified with this indentured servitude and moving out from that.
Yeah, you know, and in a sense of trying to reconstruct a new kind of national identity. You know?
Right.
And yeah, and with some things that initially were good, and then, you know, the South had these things that they wanted to do, and hey, we need to bring back segregation, we need to draw these lines back, you know, just how identity gets shaped, and just, it was just interesting for me, and just, for me, like, the heaviness of just that weight, that I'm German, I'm black, and it comes with so much heft, you know, these words, and it just, there was a lot of similarities there, I mean, I joke about them, but, you know, there was just a lot of similarity there for me.
And you don't have any control over what you're born into, and, you know, and how you sort of move through your life and realize the weight of that stuff, that's your own thing.
Yeah, sure, I mean, you know, you get to figure out how you want to cope, you know, and we were talking about my mom earlier, you know, I just saw my sisters yesterday. And we're so appreciative that our mom never told us, I never had any conversations with her about being black or any of this when I was young. And she just kind of left it up to us to figure out how we wanted to cope, you know, how we wanted to learn, you know, the social mores and stuff, and how we wanted, you know, we just left it up to us. And so, yeah, my whole family is weird about this stuff. We don't really think about these things in the way that a lot of people do.
Is that a plus?
Yeah, I think it is a plus for us, you know, because we, neither of us, the word my sister used the other day was boundaries. We don't have a ton of boundaries about shit. At least we think we don't.
And
I think that's definitely a plus.
Yeah. So it seems like, you know, when I got the sellout, so I start reading this book and, you know, it just opens with, it just like you're right in it. There's a dude handcuffed to a chair, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Waiting to be, you know, to sit, stand before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's weed involved, and there's a lot of things going on. Now, you know, moving in from what we were talking about, and in terms of how you're talking about, you know, identifying the meaning of these things, it seems like this book is sort of a reckoning with it.
Yeah, I guess so. What does reckoning mean?
I mean that, you know, it is about race.
I guess. I mean, yeah. I mean, he is who he is. You know, I am who I am. So it just shapes. It always is about race.
But when,
so it's like,
oh, right.
It's
okay.
Always, you know.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, but these are things that are important to him. These are things that factors that have shaped how he lives
Bon-Bon.
His life. Yeah, Bon-Bon, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
You know. And so, yeah, of course.
What
it's
is his
about
whole name?
That.
The main character
doesn't have a whole. I think in my head, there's a name. You know, his last name is Me.
Yeah.
So.
yeah, I was like, I was looking for it. I'm like, I'm about to talk to him, but I can't remember the character's name. So it's not my fault.
No, not at all. Not at all.
We get Foy Cheshire. We get the old man's name.
Yeah.
We get a lot of people's name around him, but he doesn't have a name.
He, you know, he's got a nickname and he's got a surname, but he doesn't really have like a Christian name.
But when you're like, when you're writing poetry and you say things like, you know, you're crafting these words, the words are important, and that, you know, early on you're writing things that we're not making sense to people.
Yeah.
And you got the support early on from one guy who said that's because you're doing something that people are going to have to come to.
Yeah.
But you're committing to these words.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're thinking about
absolutely.
Them. So, you know, these there's definitely poetry in this book, obviously, but there are also big ideas that are driving the narrative.
Yeah.
You know, specifically you have this, you know, this odd, you know, black character who wants to segregate the schools and reinstate slavery in his neighborhood.
Sort of. He doesn't
kinda.
Really do it.
Right.
But that's the thing. It's the power of these words. You know, he never segregates anything because it's already fucking segregated.
Right.
So that was the fun of it for me.
Yeah.
Is how do you segregate something that's already segregated?
Right.
Where you don't have any white people anywhere near the place you know, for the most part.
Right.
You know, how do you do that? How do you build in that notion, that consciousness of segregation? So that was really fun for me.
Yeah.
You know? How do you have a slave that's not a slave? You know what I mean? And how do you have a masochistic slave who actually enjoys being beat? You know, like all these kind of things are fun for me to just to, I don't know, reckoning is not the word that I would use because it feels like that there's a finality to that. For me, it's just a rendering, not a reckoning.
You weren't looking to make a point.
No, not at all. No, not at all. Not at all. I what's the point to be made? You know, it's like,
Yeah,
I'm not trying to change anyone's mind or anything. Make you think a little bit, make you feel, make you tingle, make you something,
laugh.
I don't know, laugh, whatever.
How long did it take you to write this book?
It took like 5 years to write that book, man. It took a long, long time.
What's your process?
I just had these ideas, you know, so I had an idea for the Hominy character because I had like, this thing, I love the Little Rascals.
The old slave.
Yeah. So I love the Little Rascals.
Yeah.
And I always thought of, like, who was next in line? You know how it went, like, Farina, Stymie. I don't know. Did you watch the Little Rascals?
Sure, Alfalfa.
Yeah. But, you know, like, for the black guys, it was Farina, then Stymie. They kind of bring him in slowly, and then they bring Buckwheat in slowly. And I was like, well, who was Buckwheat's understudy? Like, who was that next person who has the racial zeitgeist change, just missed his chance at stardom?
Yeah.
You know? Like, who was
the next black kid.
Yeah, exactly. So I just love the phrase Buckwheat's understudy. So I had that.
That's all you had?
No, I had a couple of things. I had that. I had the sense of that neighborhood, you know, this place that's California.
Dickens,
you know, that's agrarian at the same time, that's whatever the inner city's supposed to be, at the, you know, all these kind of things. And
but was once a farming community.
Yeah, sort of. You
right.
know? And so I had that. And I had the kind of notion about segregation, but I didn't really know what it was. But I knew I wanted to kind of figure out this idea of what segregation is. And
for yourself.
Not for myself, but just to render it like in this contemporary kind of way.
Yeah.
You know, talk about something that exists that we don't really acknowledge very much.
Right.
You know, I was talking with a friend of mine, Mexican American guy who runs a magazine called Zizava, Oscar.
Yeah.
And I was talking to one of my students who was interning, a black kid named Chris. And Chris was talking, we were drinking, and Chris was looking at me and Oscar's about my age, you know, late 40 or so.
Yeah.
And Chris goes, oh, you guys must have had it so hard. And me and Oscar looked at him, what are you talking about? And he's like, oh, all the racism you guys must have faced. And me and Oscar just started laughing. And we both, like, almost in unison said to him, oh, no, you had it. You have it way worse than we have it. You know, because there's just a...
What is he?
Chris is an African-American kid from, you know, from Northern California, smart kid, you know? And it was interesting to hear Oscar, me and Oscar say this thing at the same time, you know, just give this improvised riff. I know you guys have it worse than we had it.
Yeah.
Because they have a, they feel a limitation of always having to say the right thing and not being able to acknowledge anything because it means that something.
You mean, younger people.
Yeah. And for us, that was like, yeah, no, we can just spout and complain and bitch and moan, and you guys aren't allowed to bitch and moan, really, because then something's wrong with you if you're bitch and moan, because everything's in place for you to, you know, be whoever you want to be. So anyways, and it was interesting. And it just made me shape about just this idea of post-racial, all this fucking crap, you know. But I never, again, these are words that I don't know what the fuck they mean, you know.
Well, clearly they seem to mean less than they might have thought to have meant initially.
Yeah, but it's with a lot of stuff, you know, and so.
So you think that things are relatively unchanging?
I think that things do change, but I think, you know, we as people remain the fucking same, you know, it always have remained the same. And I remember reading the old WPA slave narratives, you know, where they went around to these living slaves and to keep artists employed and they interviewed these living slaves. What was it like? Dun-dun-dun, tell me about your life. And I remember reading some of those things and listening to these. Depends. You could tell who the interviewer was by the how they were talking, what words they used, and how they. Anyways, but I remember being blown away how the a lot of the slaves was, you know, these niggas, these this, and I was like, oh my god, I thought black people started saying niggas in the '70s. You know what I mean? But you just realize how old all this shit is.
Yeah,
you know, and it helps in the, you know, it's a weird way. How I think about L.A.
Yeah,
you know, all these words that just don't die. Yeah. Rad, gnarly, you know. All these words, you know. So, yeah. And for me, it's like more about the timelessness and about like how do we measure progress. I'm not saying there is no progress, you know, but it's like how do we measure it? You know, like, okay, is Obama progress? Yes, no, how? You know, is the Civil Rights Act progress? You know, all this kind of stuff. For me, it's just, it's fun to play with. You know?
And when something happens like what's happening now in our culture, how does that zap your brain?
Wait, so what's now? Like, what's this what?
That we shift, about? The shift from Obama to a reaction like Trump.
Yeah, I mean, these shifts happen, you know? I mean, there's a reason that we've, you know, that the shift went from Obama to Trump and not, you know, Obama to Paul Ryan or Obama to Kucinich, you know, there's a reason why they picked this guy. And what those reasons are exactly, I don't really know. You know, I have my ideas.
Yeah.
And these things happen, again, back to Germany, like this thing of people feeling censored, even though they aren't fucking censored, but they feel censored. Somebody's telling them that they're censored. And we were talking earlier about, like, you know, the when do you have the lattice work for a totalitarian state, you know? And I think, you know, we're so used, but these things break down, you know? Hitler was fucking elected. They elected that fucker twice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's about this breakdown of, like, how these things break down. And that's the stuff that really gets scary for me, you know? Because you adapt so easily to losing things.
Yeah.
You know, people and all your rights, your accessibility. I mean, you adapt.
What do you think that's from?
I don't know. That's from a lot of stuff. I think a lot of it is, you know, it's hard to acknowledge things that if you want to change, you're actually going to have to change your behavior. You're actually going to have to shift your life around, you know, and make some real sacrifices, you know. And it's so hard for people to notice this stuff. You know, there's just, you have a kind of, you know, you have a kind of kinetic energy in your life that you're just, you know, you don't want to disrupt that flow, you
right.
know?
And, yeah.
And it's hard to admit that these people fucking hate me.
Yeah.
You know, and especially people that you've been around for so long.
Yeah.
And this person who was your neighbor, all of a sudden you're this person's worst enemy. I remember when talking to a friend about OJ being acquitted.
Yeah.
And she was talking to somebody, a woman who was a lawyer, and she was so angry, you know, this, you know, miscarriage of justice. And she went, yeah, I got to rethink my stance on affirmative action, on all this kind of shit. And I went, what does that fucking have to do with OJ getting off?
Yeah.
But it's this way of associating African-Americanness, this country, whose country is it? You know, and the way that good people become bad also, you know, my wife tells a story about, you know, her step-grandfather grew up in Hamburg, you know, in the early 30s. And they had this teacher, you know, this beautiful guy who all the students liked. And they would ask him, oh, so what about Hitler? And he'd be like, ah, don't worry about that. There's, you know, nothing to worry about. You know, they can't do any of this stuff. None of it makes sense. And no. You know, but then one day he came in and he went, class, there's a fresh wind blowing. You know, like at some point the rhetoric got to him. There was something in him.
Yeah.
That, you know, and you know, my wife's grandfather's Jewish and he has to rethink about, fuck, he doesn't even see me. He doesn't, you know, you just...
Right.
These things happen.
Yeah.
You know, these things happen. It's not like, bing, you press a button and then everybody's a fucking fascist.
Yeah.
But, you know, these things click. And some of it's fear. I mean, it clicks for a ton of reasons.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, I just want to be on the winning side, you know?
Right,
and,
sure.
Clicks for a ton of reasons. And for me, like, there's an interesting thing about, like, who's the sellout? Like, you know, what's the sellout?
Right.
You know, and that notion is in any kind of thing, you know? And I, a friend of mine gave me a book. It's called The Directory of Uncle Tom's. It's a fucking beautiful book.
Yeah.
Really well researched.
When was that about?
Oh, God. That book must be from the mid-90s, I think. Maybe a little bit later.
Who wrote it?
I don't know. I don't think anybody's name is on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's such a good book. So you name anybody, Urkel, any black person who's ever done anything in life, they're in that book. Because at some level, this is where this person has sold. It's just... This, like, whose sensibility, like, whose sense of what blackness is are we talking about?
Yeah.
I love that book. It's really funny. It's really well researched, too. It's a really good book. But it's like, you know, but for me, it's like these things aren't, like, just tied in being black.
Right.
So, like, we were talking about the kid, the guy doesn't have a name. And so I had a line that I liked in my head. It was like, you know, all this Supreme Court, you know, Roe versus Wade, you know.
Yeah.
Gore versus the United States of America, whatever these cases are. And I had a funny thing about, oh, me versus the United States of America, that's kind of funny. So then I have to come up with a way of, well, how do I justify this non-existent surname?
Yeah.
You know, so I go, oh, yeah, they were the me's. And then I use all these things, but these examples for me, which are really interesting, about mostly these Jewish guys changing their names and doing all this kind of stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, all these comedians, all these people who I really admire, but like this, that process is so familiar to a ton of people.
Right,
changing your name
to be more appealing.
To be
and
more
less
appealing, is that a sellout? Is that, you know, like what are we talking about here? And so, I don't know. That's one of my favorite parts in the book, actually. You know,
but
it's like, who are his exemplars for these behaviors? Aren't always necessarily black. You know, they're
right.
Just from all over the place. And
what are your biggest comedic influences? What was the...
That's a good question.
But I mean, what the anthology, I don't have it, but when you put together an anthology of black humor, you know, what it seemed like a very, at least diverse within the forms.
Yeah, well, I think Malcolm X is hilarious. So I put in all this kind of stuff, you know, from Malcolm X.
On purpose?
Yeah, absolutely on purpose, you know, because I just think he's fucking funny. And, you know, in addition to being a ton of other things, he's just also funny. And so there's a ton of my comedic influences. My family's pretty funny. Richard Pryor, of course, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Sitting around listening to all those albums, Franklin Ajay.
Oh, yeah.
Carl Reiner. You know, like when you sat down and listened to
2000-year-old
you know,
man.
Yeah, of course. All hilarious. That kind of stuff, you know.
Well, because people, like I see in like some of the press on the book that they want to keep comparing it to stand-up. And as a stand-up, this goes far beyond the capability of stand-up.
I don't know if I agree with you there, to be honest. You know, I can't believe that's a nice thing to say, I think.
No, I mean that you have, you know, because of your, you know, all stand-ups use words, and some stand-ups have great bits, and some of those bits, you know, transcend time and are with us forever.
Sure.
But in terms of nuance that can, you know, keep pushing... I'm just saying, it's a lot of writing.
Yeah. No, that part is different.
You're not doing bits.
Yeah, but I think...
You are doing some bits,
No, but I mean, you know, if I think of, like, comedy that's moved me and has stayed with me, it's not about the volume.
Of course
you
not.
You know, it's about
the punch.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are some of those?
So this is the thing, you know, like... You know, this concept of blackface. Blackface is bad, blah, blah, blah. You know, you don't do it. You don't do this thing.
Yeah, there's some blackface in the book.
Yeah, of course, you know. Because, I mean, there's a ton of legacies. There's this Hollywood legacy, this whole thing. So it has to be in there. So, you know, and I remember, you must know this. Maybe you don't. But do you remember this old Saturday Night Live skit where Billy Crystal plays this Negro League baseball player?
Yeah.
And he's in the blackest of fucking blackface.
Yeah.
He's talking about Smelt Night.
Yeah.
And talking about, it's so fucking funny.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where I guess, is it racist? Is it not? I don't fucking know, but it is funny.
Right.
And I remember talking to my friend Daryl about this a lot. And I'm like, well, how did he get away with this? And, you know, somebody else does it and, you know, they don't get away with it. And my friend Daryl goes, you know why? For whatever it is he cared about this. Like he, there was a genuine something
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
And he was invested in a real personal way. And you can maybe argue that with, you know, Al Jolson, maybe sure, you could argue sure. that, but it's different. It's still yeah. different.
Right.
And, well, they're, you know, two different time periods and this whole thing. Yeah, I think everyone always has these rules. It's this is bad, this is not bad. This is when you can laugh, when you can't laugh. All this kind of shit. And I mean, I laugh at the wrong time all the time.
Well, yeah, but that's sort of the beauty of comedy. I mean, it's like, you know, is it the wrong time? You know, what, you know, why is somebody laughing?
Yeah.
You know, those are personal questions sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's...
And I think like in terms of like whatever Billy Crystal was doing and whatever Al Jolson was doing was that, you know, there was a tradition that had become, you know, inappropriate at some point. But I don't think that if you were to ask Billy about that guy, he would say it was a blackface character.
He might not. I don't know what the hell he would
was
say.
Not, I don't know that he was doing minstrelsy per se.
Yeah.
But, you know, at some point, you know, if you put any of that black on your face,
yeah.
you, then you are identifying with the legacy.
So, but it's the thing of, like, how these words are tied. Like, so, do you remember Sarah Palin being on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah.
And I was like, this is just, she's a coon. You yeah. know, it's the same fucking thing, being forced to laugh at yourself when you really don't want to laugh.
Right.
But, you know.
Yeah.
And, but that's your way of ingratiating yourself with your potential electorate or whatever she's doing, you know?
Sure.
I just, these weird ways, you know? And so for me, I see these behaviors all the time in different capacities, you know, not so much always tied to race. You know, as you said, there's different traditions or different legacies, you know, but the behavior is, it crosses all that kind of stuff, you yeah. know?
And you do that in the book all over the place.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is that, you know, you have all these different threads of thought and identity and entertainment, you know, that, you know, that you turn in on themselves by having these weird behaviors of these, you know, these like white girls and stuff, you know, putting on black faces,
yeah, yeah.
being part of this audience. There's so much in the book. I can't remember bits and pieces.
Neither can I. So,
I mean, like it's pretty fascinating. The fury of pace and imagery that you get in these things. I mean, when you say you took 5 years to do it, like I can't even go through all the different tiers of, I mean, Christ, there's enough about farming fruit in there
yeah.
to, you know, write a whole other piece on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you, at yeah. some point you nerded out about farming.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's growing up from, you know, it starts from these little stupid things of growing up in California, you yeah. know, having a lemon tree in the backyard, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah. And it just grew out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, absolutely.
Well, you know, what was brought to mind was that, you know, in talking about, there was something interesting that Spike Lee did with that, with the movie Bamboozled.
Yeah.
That I can't ever get out of my head
but, yeah.
was to bring contemporary sort of focused production values to you know, a minstrel show.
Yeah.
And to put it on in that, you know, with that spectacle.
Yeah.
Was sort of fucking mind blowing.
Yeah, you know, I love the idea of that movie. God, I'm usually not so critical in public of shit.
Yeah.
But I love the idea of that movie. But the problem was is that the minstrel show wasn't fucking funny.
Uh-huh.
So for me, it just debased the whole thing of this thing blowing up because I was like, I love this idea, but the thing is, how do you really give that show some punch?
Right.
Like some contemporary punch that would really make it work in that context.
Right.
So I couldn't buy the movie because the minstrelsy stuff wasn't funny.
Right.
Like it was just kind of...
It seemed like it was actually from the era.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that was probably the point he was trying to make. It was probably a discussion, but I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Like, that it would have been more powerful a movie if he had made it more contemporary.
Yeah, maybe, you know.
Well, I mean, you do that with these missing episodes of the Little Rascals.
Yeah, yeah, don't talk. Yeah, you're going to be in trouble. But it's like, no, I'm teasing. But yeah, that was the fun stuff of like, how do you take this, like, you know, really patently racist show and make it even fucking more racist, you know?
Yeah.
And then like, so people come up to me, it's like, are these real episodes? You know, this whole, you know.
That's
I had so much fun, like really trying to amp that stuff up.
Isn't that though? That in itself is sort of a scary proposition that people don't have the facility to understand something as broad as that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, was that based on truth? And
yeah.
Like, really?
Yeah. No, but that, you know, sometimes it depends, again, like who asked those questions. You know, like where are they coming from? You know, I had a friend of mine who thought Al Jolson was black. You know, this is a very smart guy. And he has, it's just like, whoa. But it's like, you know, what? Where do you look? You know, like, you know. It's so contextual all the time. You know, that I think that's a big thing about how contextual all this shit is.
Yeah.
You know.
Everybody's got those weird blind sides that are surprising.
And it, so, Little Rascals, this is Boston. You know, me and my friend Kevin would, like, go to Beacon, because Beacon would do these revival things.
The Beacon Theater?
No, it was in, where was it?
What are you talking about?
It might have been in Brookline or
Coolidge Corner.
The Coolidge Corner Theater,
and
they would do these things. And I remember going, you'd be in these all-white things in fucking Boston, no less. And they'd watch the old Little Rascals episodes. You know, they would show Little Rascals, Three Stooges, but the uncensored versions that we never saw as kids.
Right.
You know, Stymie, like, over a hot pot sweating and then wiping his brow and flinging a black splotch on a white wall, you know, like, and just all this stuff. And the crowd laughing and all this kind of shit. And it's just stuff that really has stayed with me, obviously, for a long, long time. Because you're talking about, how do we figure this out?
Why are they laughing?
Why are they laughing? Why am I laughing? Why am I not laughing? You know, all this kind of stuff. What's really going on here? Not really going on, but what's going on a little bit. And just, I don't know, just stuff really stayed with me. You know?
Do you get any rest from your brain?
Do I get any rest? Yeah, I think so. You know, I watch television and I read and...
So when you say this took you 5 years, why the stopping and starting?
It wasn't stopping and starting. I'm just really slow.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah. I'm really slow. And
meticulous?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the stuff's very important to me, you know. And
in terms of getting the words right?
Yeah, just in terms of getting the words right, because it's all the language, man. You know, it's that's the stuff that, you know, brings me joy, is hopefully that the book's written well, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the crap. And that takes me a long, long, long time, you know.
And what is your question about what satire is?
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's just, it's these words that people hide behind it. Because you get to say, oh, something satirical, and you don't have to, what does that mean? You know, like, what are we satirizing? Am I being satirized? You know, it's a good thing of, it's a good deflecting word. Like, this has nothing to do with me. I have no culpability. It's like, I am out of this. You know? So it's a word. But it's much, much more than that. You know, it's, you know, I think about all this stuff. Like, I had to teach a satire class.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And I called it, like, too soon or not soon enough. You know, because, like, this idea of, like, when are things funny? You know, we're talking about this Lubitsch movie, you know, To Be or Not to Be.
Yeah.
Which is a fucking brilliant movie that, of course, was too close.
The Nazi movie.
Yeah. You know, not American enough and all these other kind of things. And but it's a fucking classic.
And how do they react? How you deal with, you know, what are you thinking of the younger kids?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're all so fucking smart.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to see, you know, the sense of right and wrong blur about like what they can do.
Yeah.
You know, they're so uncomfortable because, you know, they get told, you can't use this language. You can't do this. You can't do that. And just to just see, you know, especially they read Portnoy's Complaint.
Yeah.
And a lot of them hadn't read it, which is, you know, I mean, it's such a seminal book for me, you know, because I'm like, oh, yeah, you can do this. I know you could do this. Good, you know. And, you know, and a lot of the, you know, were like, how do you do this as a woman? How come women don't write like this? You know, which is not true that women do or don't like that. But, you know, like, it's interesting. They just get these narrow things about what writing is, about what these things are. And so for me, I'm just trying to give them stuff of people doing the unexpected.
Do whatever you feel like doing.
Yeah.
Put it out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely.
So what has been, you know, the sort of black academic reaction to the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think good, I hope. You know, I don't read a ton of the reviews.
You
so,
don't?
You know, no, I don't. I kind of read them at the beginning, and then every now and then somebody will put, especially my wife will be like, you have to read this one. So I read some. I can't say like I don't read any of them, but I think good as far as I can tell. You know, I mean, I think
it was provocative. I mean, if they're writing about it, you know, the best you can hope from a critical essay is that you take a couple of hits, but at least they see something maybe you didn't even anticipate.
Yeah, you know, I just try to do some shit that only I can do, you know, and yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, really, you know, and so. And I think, you know, it's, you know, I'm not the only weirdo out there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the only person who feels certain some type of way. So, you know, I have a thing, just, it's not about necessarily black, but it's about like when people pander, you know? And
yeah.
So I just try not to pander.
Right.
And,
yeah. Oh, no, I understand that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. and try not to pander my own way, you know? And so I had a student once came up to me and she was, you know, she identified with the LGBT community.
Yeah.
She was like, you know, I want to ridicule all this kind of stuff and satirize all this kind of stuff, but I'm so afraid, you know, because we've worked so hard to create what little space we have.
Yeah.
And I don't want to make fun of it. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but everything that you add, whether it's accepted, rejected, whatever, that adds to that space. You know?
Right.
That adds to that
interesting
space.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just trying to, because I'm really not trying to add to anybody else's space. I'm just trying to, you know.
Sure.
Get my own.
Well, I think that's an interesting point.
You know.
That, you know, that anything that provokes whatever, you know, dogmatic or structural limitations of a space that is presented as dire or a need to be maintained to guarantee that space.
Yeah.
You know, if you push on it, sometimes that space gets a little sense of humor.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah, because oftentimes
a little reflection.
A little reflection. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, does something like this become interesting to a movie person?
I guess there's been some interest in it. Like, I actually sold the rights, and I'm trying to and for the first time, I've actually agreed to do the screenplay. Like, I've always said I'm not going to do the screenplay.
Wow.
So
how do you do that? Because
I have no idea, Mark. I've started on it. I have no idea.
It's because, like, if you look at, like, Catch-22.
Sure.
Like, you know, which is pretty disjointed, but pretty stunning.
Yeah. You mean the film?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like
you have, you have Garfunkel's fro. So.
Yeah. It's and Alan Arkin being crazy.
Yeah.
but like that movie, when you read that book, it's like you can never imagine the breadth of that, you know, being a film. And then you see this film and it's a very surreal experience.
Yeah.
It's a disjointed but beautiful experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like translating stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's, you know, so I think you always lose something, you know, book the film, sometimes, you know, film the book, you lose something,
you
know?
Yeah.
And so I think that just goes with it. So I'm just going to try to have fun with it and try not to rewrite the book as a movie. You
know,
try to make it different in a weird way.
Sure.
And so that's my challenge, you know. So I don't know what will happen. We'll see, man.
Well, it's great talking to you, man.
Same, Mark, man. Pleasure, man.
Smart guy. Great writer. The Sellout's an amazing book. I'm glad he stopped by. It was nice to talk to him. Yeah, go to WTFpod.com for the upcoming tour dates. I'll see you tomorrow night, Austin, Texas. Please don't scream for me to save John Frusciante. I don't know where he's at. but come see me. It's been good. It's been funny. All right, let's see if I can play some music here. Boomer lives!